This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio. Sitting in for Libby, here is Tasha Kiridan.
Happy Monday and happy first Monday of the new year. That means that if you're like me, it's back to work. And if you're an Ontario civil servant, it's also back to the office 5 days a week. We're going to ask our Zoomer squad if that would make them happy or set them dusting off their resume. We're also going to talk about other big stories. Canadian Advocacy Group says that there has been a 47% increase in senior homelessness in the last few years. And another study shows that snowbirds are skipping the United States. You might be surprised to see where they are wintering instead. At 12:30, author and tech critic Cory Doctorow is going to join us to unpack a book about the, well, I can't say the word quite, but the NSification of the internet. Yes, S stands for crap, let's just say, the clogging of all the things you see with everything from pop-up ads to AI-generated content. And he asks the question of whether this can be changed. Or is it just going to get worse? And then at 12:45, we're going to turn to the ongoing events in Venezuela with Roxana Vigil of the Council of Foreign Relations, assessing what comes next for the country and the region, as well as lawyer Jeremy Paul to discuss the legal aspects of these events and just what awaits Nicolas Maduro as he faces American justice. We're going to also ask you if you could be kind enough to text us. Yes. The elves have gone, but the squirrels are still nibbling on our phone lines. So please, we would invite your comments, questions, anything you want to say to our superb text line, 1-866-740-4740. That's 1-866-740-4740. Please join in the show, join in the fun. All this coming up right now on Fight Back.
And now, time for the Zoomer Squad.
All right. I have the pleasure of being joined on the line by Anthony Quinn, president of CARP, and Liz West, host of the Afternoon Express right here on Zoomer Radio, and in studio by David Valentin, principal at Liaison Strategies. Welcome, everybody.
Hi.
Happy New Year.
Hi, Tasha.
Hey, Happy New Year. I hope you had a restful weekend before heading back to work. But before we talk about that workplace story, I am going to be talking about Venezuela at the back end of the show, but I still have to ask you whether you had this on your bingo card for the first weekend of the new year, that all of a sudden the U.S. would be basically invading is not the quite right word, but taking the president prisoner and causing all these issues in the news. You thought Ukraine was the focus, and now it's switched to Venezuela. I got to ask you, David, I'll start with you. Did you see this coming? Were you surprised to turn on your TV Saturday and go, oh, they kidnapped the president of Venezuela?
Well, you know, my family is from Peru. I was born in Peru, came here when I was five, and the Peruvian shamans at the beginning of the year made some predictions. They predicted that the Venezuelan president would be deposed.
Really?
They predicted peace for Ukraine, and they predicted a mystery illness for President Trump. So, you know, one out of three has come true.
Wow. We'll
take a look at the others.
Gosh, you know, that is really interesting. I was hoping for peace in Ukraine. I hadn't seen the Venezuela thing coming. I don't know, Liz, were you taken aback by the news this weekend or just go, oh, that's just, you know, 2026 can be just like 2025?
No, I wasn't completely surprised, only because of the activity and the pressure he was putting on the ships, the Venezuelan ships, mm-hmm. Over the past month or so. So I knew that he was exerting a certain amount of influence or whatever you want to call it. And to be honest, I feel a little uneducated around what's happening exactly, and also what's happened historically. From what I have heard in the last few hours from different experts is that this isn't entirely out of character for the United States. But it's also, not surprising for someone like Donald Trump, I don't think. Like, I my first thought was, of course, that's what he's done. And I think what's really important is that we get clear on the motivation. And this isn't about an altruistic worldview, but rather this is some kind of a power play.
Yeah, and a powerful play right at the beginning of the year, Anthony. You know, I'm old enough to remember, as most of our listeners probably are, when Manuel Noriega was kidnapped from Panama 36 years ago. I felt like I was flashing back to that. When you saw this news, what was your reaction?
Well, I was reminded of the invasion into the Middle East by the U.S. Years ago. Mm-hmm. But I was also really excited to see the joy in the faces of the Venezuelans in the morning when they took to the streets celebrating the end of the Maduro dictatorship. So I think overall positive news, and I'm hoping that the intention stated by the American leadership is as they've promised to free the people.
Yeah, and we'll see how this plays out. Of course, at the end of the show, we'll be talking to a couple of experts about all those issues that are still in play and in flux in Venezuela. A little closer to home, as I said earlier, we are all back to work. And civil servants in Ontario are now back to work full time this week, 5 days a week. The union is not happy about it. In fact, they're saying this is a big mistake. And so I want to put to our listeners and to our panel too, how you would react if you were in their shoes. Would you, do you feel that going back to work 5 days a week is a must do? Or would it have you trying to think of maybe another job? Would that be a deal breaker for you? 1-866-740-4740 is the number to text. 1-866-740-4740. You know, I'll start with you, David. If you were told you had to be back in 5 days a week, would that make you think of looking for another job? And is it also, or is it just that, you know, these civil servants should be there? Is it a good thing for them to come back?
Well, personally, I like being in the office and seeing my coworkers. I guess it all depends on who your coworkers are and how you get along.
That's true.
But, you know, one of the things I would have to wonder about is that the premier was asked this morning, you know, is there even enough space for all these people?
Right.
A lot of different departments are saying they actually sold off government land, you know, in the name of efficiencies and all these things, and to make the government some money, to be honest. And so now they have to house all these civil employees who are coming back. You know, if we're going to be crammed like sardines, I don't think I would want to be and take any part of that, right? So I think the question is, you know, what is the layout? Is it just all open space now? Do the people get their own offices? I mean, there's questions here that I think have to be answered in terms of quality of work. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if I was going back to just my regular office work, I'd be happy with that. I'd be fine with that.
Okay. Liz, you know, David makes a good point. I do know a couple of civil servants who told me that during the pandemic, things changed. They downsized so that people didn't have to be in the office all the time and space was reduced. And that might not be a really fun environment. What's your take on this? Do you think that people should be back in the office 5 days a week, or is that unrealistic?
Well, I think given that this is the civil servants, that the government likes to lead by example. And if they're looking at the health and wellness of our cities and all the infrastructure that supports business, forget traffic, because that just becomes a worse nightmare, obviously. But, you know, hopefully improving public transit, that then they've got to walk the talk, because they do that certainly when it comes to benefits and you know, supporting employees in the workplace. So I think that goes with the job, and like with any job, I mean, looking at the way they rolled this out, people had a lot of notice of when they would have to be back in the office 4 days a week, and a lot of notice 5 days a week. It's unfortunate. It's January, because this is the worst weather to be commuting in. Wouldn't it be great if it was in April or May? That was kind of, in fact, I actually hate the Monday start for anything. It should be started on a Wednesday and started on a beautiful day, and everything's going to be a lot more palatable. This particular January 5th in the middle of a day like today could not have been worse. But I say you got to walk the talk.
Yeah, there's probably a lot of people saying, oh, can it not be a snow day today or coming in late? And in fact, the Star reported in December that of the 60,000 Ontario government employees that are affected by this, 11,000 requested alternative work arrangements, seeking to stay home at least one day a week. Anthony, are they being unreasonable, or should, you know, or something here that they want to keep from the pandemic that makes sense?
Yeah, I think the pandemic combined with the generational change in attitude towards working in the office have combined. And just the mindset now is that being in the office isn't something that younger workers are looking to do, or they want ultimate flexibility. And I think, as Liz said, from a public service point of view, the expectation from the taxpayers is that there's more accountability, and that accountability comes with being in the office and being seen to do your work and making sure that the taxpayers are getting value for that money.
David, do you think this is a generational thing?
Absolutely. And, you know, we've seen research that sort of shows the attitudes towards work are very different for younger people, especially people who are working. In many cases, their first job might not be a traditional job the way, you know, you used to get back in retail or something like that. Sometimes your first job is working in an incubator where the rules are very different in terms of how you're working with companies, how you're working with bosses. And, you know, once you're in that mindset, it can be really tough to transition to a different one, right? But if you're a public servant, I mean, depending on what your job is, some of these jobs are a lot better tooled for doing things in the office. Some of these jobs might be better tooled for not. So I hope that when people are making these decisions, they're looking at the job description and asking themselves, you know, what makes the most sense for this posting?
Yeah, and these postings, though, what's happening here is it's a blanket go back to work. So it doesn't seem to matter what your individual circumstances are. Liz, I'm going to ask you, and not because you're the woman on the panel, but I was reading a study in The Atlantic which showed that women and commutes are not a happy marriage. Many women, when they are faced with a commute, choose to take a job that's closer to home that maybe doesn't even pay as much, or they reduce their hours because of the commute. And I'm wondering if you think that this will have a disproportionate impact on women. Is that any experience that you've had or talked about with anyone else that you know?
That's interesting. I'm wondering what the background is on the difference between women and commutes and men and commutes. For me personally, I feel like it's a waste of my time when I'm sitting in traffic because I've got 20 million other things to do. And perhaps the men can tell me on the panel it was because they like to just relax and listen to a podcast and aren't thinking about the 20 million, maybe there aren't 20 million tasks flying through their brain. But what I did want to also add, Tasha, is that, you know, with every choice of a job, there are pros and cons. There are things you get and there's sacrifices you make to get them. And when you look at the civil service, they have a very protected job environment. They have a great pension, great benefits for maternity, for health benefits. And this is a trade-off. And for all the people, the young people, whoever it is that are not loving the idea of having to show up somewhere 5 days a week, there are plenty of other jobs, but you won't necessarily get all those, let's call them perks, with the job. And I think that adults have to take responsibility for their decisions and say, I chose to do this because, you know, I like having the benefits. I like the protection. And as a result, yeah, the job means you show up 5 days a week. That's the job.
Yeah, Anthony, I think most people of at least Gen X and older, you know, our normal was going to work 5 days a week, 6 days a week sometimes. It didn't matter. And if you had benefits like they do in the civil service, you would sort of make that calculation too, that it was worth it. Do you think that there's a way to maybe impress that upon younger workers that there is this trade-off? Do you think enough emphasis is made? Because the union is saying, no, everyone should just be able to do what they want. Without regard for the fact that, as Liz pointed out, you get a lot of perks when you work for the civil service in Ontario.
I think the union will continue to do that type of thing that they do on behalf of their employees. But when it comes to getting ahead in your career and establishing yourself in the office, in the workplace, I think you have to be seen and to connect with your your managers and your administrators so that they see the value of you as an employee. And that's how you are able to advance in your career. And sitting at home attached to a phone or a computer, I think that disconnects them from the opportunities for advancement in the career. And I think they'll learn that as they're back in the office.
It also disconnects them from mentorship. And, you know, David, I remember when I was a young lawyer way, way back in the day, it was, you know, we worked very hard, long hours, but it was still that networking with older lawyers and colleagues that helped you get a sense of the job and also, you know, get better at it. And I'm wondering how, if that is lost today, if people realize how important that is by being in the office.
Well, I think a lot of different skills are lost. And, you know, when we have interns in our own company and when we do research, we find younger generations are more allergic to phone calls, mm-hmm. are more allergic to in-person meetings. You know, why isn't it going to an email or a text? Sometimes a phone call can be more effective, can be more persuasive, right? There's reasons that we've trained our staff why it's good to do things on the phone as opposed to email, which can be quite impersonal. But, you know, I've heard from my friends, some of their workers are afraid to answer the phone.
Really?
And they have to be trained how to do it. Well, I mean, you have to remember, there's a generation of workers now who graduated and were in university during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And they lost a lot, and you know, it affected them particularly a lot in terms of the opportunities they had for co-op, in terms of the opportunities they had for work experience. Look at the job market there is now. The youth unemployment rate is still quite high, especially here in Ontario. So the jobs that people have had access to, some people are working in offices now, and they don't have the same level of experience and socialization that they did as the previous generation. You know, it's not all their fault. They went through a very unique circumstance, but now they need to sort of catch up, right?
Yeah, and the question is how you do that catch up too, because just throwing them on the phones may not be as effective. Of course, you can't hide behind ChatGPT when you answer someone on the phone.
Correct.
So there's that too. Liz, I do want to address one point that you raised earlier in this chat about the return to work, and that is the commute and the congestion. A lot of the arguments are centered around this is bad for the environment. Everyone's going to pile into their cars. You know, maybe they won't take public transit. They'll just get there on their own, and this is bad. You know, do you think that's a valid argument for people not going back to work?
Well, I think it's a convenient argument for people not going back to work, because if there was handed free tickets to the World Cup to go, they might, or to see Coldplay or whatever, they would hop in their cars and go and not think twice about it, right? So I think it's really convenient to, and I think it's a fair argument. As someone who has commuted every day through every situation because of the job I do, I have really enjoyed all those people staying in their cozy pajamas mm-hmm. and working from home. Like, it's been fantastic, absolutely fantastic. And even now, I know Mondays will be good, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, busy, Friday, busy for different reasons, but I know kind of who's commuting and when they're commuting. So it's completely legitimate. It is going to make life difficult. And listen, I hate the idea of commuting, especially if you're coming from somewhere 45 to an hour away because of traffic. Like, I empathize. It sucks. There is no two ways about it. And I think it does have a negative impact on our mental health. It really does. But at the same time, as you pointed out, like, people don't know what they don't know. There are huge benefits to being in the office. First of all, there's camaraderie, and there's also opportunity to learn, opportunity to grow and to move within the company that I just don't buy can be replaced virtually.
Yeah, I'm with you. In fact, Jerry in Markham here has texted, at the end of the day, our economy does not have a surplus of office-bound jobs that disgruntled civil servants could jump ship to, particularly with the cushy benefits they receive. So I think that, coupled with what you just said, probably indicates that they are not going to be all fleeing to other prospects. and trying to find something else to do. Okay, we're going to talk about a couple other stories before we wrap up here. One of those is a really not good news story. A group called CanAge, that is a seniors advocacy group, says that there's been a 47% increase in senior homelessness between 2021 and 2024. And as of 2022, StatsCan says 27%, that's more than one in four people, of homeless Canadians are over the age of 50. So this is a growing problem. Anthony, I'll start with you. How distressing are these numbers? Is this square with what you're hearing?
Well, I think it's most likely directly connected to the aging of the population more than it is a reflection of an increase in seniors who are homeless. This is an increase in seniors in all points of the society. So the oldest baby boomer this year in 2026 is turning 80, and the decade behind them, there is this massive wave of Canadians who are going to expand the numbers in every category, and that includes homelessness, that includes wait times in hospitals, that includes every category. So I think it's more of an issue related to demographics, and not to downplay the concerns of homeless older adults, because they come with their own problems. They have accessibility issues, they have medical issues that are beyond the typical homeless concern. So it's a big issue, but I think it reflects just this demographic change that will affect all aspects of society in the next decade.
Okay, David, do you agree that it's just a demographic issue, or is it a cost of living issue as well?
I think there's a lot of things at play here. You know, I used to live in Montreal, and I learned while I was there that Montreal is the single senior capital of Canada.
Really?
The Suburban, which is a newspaper out in the West Island, did a whole series on single seniors. And one of the problems they were looking at, and this series is pretty old, I think it's from 5 years ago, is that a lot of the benefits for seniors are predicated upon this idea that there will be two seniors in the household, mm-hmm. not one. And so I think as demographic changes come in, as Anthony's talking about, there's also probably been a change in the population of single seniors Canada-wide versus seniors who have a partner or a spouse. And so what happens when you have this cost of living coupled with the fact that sometimes the benefits don't quite work out if you're a single person on a budget, right? These are things to consider as well. I know in Montreal, they were figuring out how to deal with the social isolation that comes from this problem. Because if you're living alone, well, there's all sorts of things that can befall you now that didn't happen before, including what happens if you fall, what happens if you sprain your ankle, but you need someone to go to the pharmacy to get your medication. So they were looking at all sorts of supports to roll out for the single senior population. I'm very curious what that looks like nationwide.
And it's also the fact that when you are in a shelter, if senior people have to go to find shelter, those shelters aren't necessarily equipped for exactly the challenges that you've just talked about. I just want to say a bit of breaking news here. Nicolas Maduro has apparently pled not guilty in a U.S. court appearance in New York. That is just broken now. We're going to be talking about that later in the show, but apparently he has pled not guilty just now. That is the breaking news to report to you. I want to touch on one last story, which is a story that a lot of people who go down south can relate to. And Liz, I'll start with you on this one. Canadian snowbirds are apparently flocking to different destinations this year, including Vancouver Island. This is a place where snowbirds who have decided not to go to the U.S. are going, and we're seeing a reduction of about 37% in travel since 2024 of Canadians going to the U.S. in general, and a lot of them not going south. How surprised are you by Vancouver as a destination, or is that just, because it's the warmest spot in the country right now?
Yep, I think that's Tasha. It's the warmest spot in the country.
Would you park your RV there? I don't know.
Well, there's ocean. You can surf with a wetsuit, maybe. I don't know. Really, there's nothing that compares to the south of, Florida. But I think it's kind of interesting that people are willing to literally give up their tradition of being in the sun and warmth because of our relationship right now with the U.S. I think it's kind of amazing. And it's tough because I'm sure many of us here have been faced with the dilemma of where do I go if I want to get away from, you know, this is the prime time. I want to get away from this Canadian winter. And my parents used to go to Victoria every February. Hmm. And they would say, oh, my gosh, the cherry blossoms are out. This is fantastic. So for certainly for an aging, the aging population, like it can be really nice just to not to get navigate snow. And also, I think there will be, it'll feel nice on the pocketbook, not dealing with the U.S. Exchange.
Yeah. Anthony, what are you hearing from the Zoomers you're talking to? Are they going to flock to Vancouver Island or other destinations on their radar?
It was about this time last year when we heard from CARP members that they were really disgruntled with Trump's treatment of Canadians and his 51st state rhetoric, and they were going to talk with their dollars. So I think this year they're holding their nose and just not traveling south at all, and that's why we've seen that big decline. That will continue, I think, until such time that there is a sense that America and Canada have fixed their relations, that the economic embargoes on Canadian vehicles and manufacturing isn't hurting our economy. But I've had no more unified voice from our members in their distaste for Trump at this time. And I think they're going to hold fast in withholding their travel dollars until they feel that the relationship is being fixed.
Okay. Well, David, you're not a senior snowbird, but you're sitting right in front of me. So evidently you have not gone anywhere. Has Trump affected your decision to travel to the U.S. or not?
Well, you know, I've thought about going, and every time I just ask myself, I've lost track of what they're doing. They have to take photos of me now. You need this thing, you need that thing. They might fingerprint you, they might go through your phone. And every single time I've said, you know, I think I'd rather just go someplace else and avoid the stress. So for me, it's been really easy. There's other places I can go, other places I haven't been yet, quite frankly, that I've been interested in going to. But, you know, of all these different barriers they're throwing up, and they're saying, you know, they even want to take pictures of babies and then hold them for, you know, you read all this stuff and you go, what is this for? Mm-hmm. Right? Why? We didn't have to go through any of this a year ago. What is happening now?
Now, we make it a hassle. People may not go. I think that's the bottom line. All right. I want to thank our Zoomer squad for being our first official New Year's Monday squad today. Anthony Quinn, Liz West, and David Valentin, thank you so much. When we come back on the other side of this, we are going to talk about the internet and just how yucky a lot of it is, clogged with disinformation, all sorts of pop-up ads when you scroll. Is your internet experience becoming too much of a chore? Could that be changed? We're going to welcome Cory Doctorow, technology critic and author, to find out how, right here on Fight Back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Tasha Kiridan.
Welcome back. We're going to do some flipping around of the show right now because there has been breaking news in the U.S. Nicolas Maduro has pled not guilty in a court appearance in New York in just the last half hour. So we're going to go to our experts on this story now. The events this weekend, of course, continue to play out, and it's quite extraordinary. Of course, as we know, American troops abducted or seized, or however you want to say it, Nicolas Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, in the early hours of Saturday morning in an operation that has left the Venezuelan government in a crisis. Nations like Cuba very nervously eyeing the U.S. next move, and a lot of questions about what's next and the legality also of all of this. Is that even a factor? Right now, is there a violation of international law? And, you know, does Donald Trump even care? All this stuff will be discussed. We have Roxana Vigil, who's an international affairs fellow in national security at the Council on Foreign Relations based in Washington, D.C. on the line, as well as Jeremy Paul, professor of law at Northeastern University School of Law. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Roxana, I'll start with you. The latest out of the U.S. being this not guilty plea. What is the mood, I guess, in Washington following these developments? What do people feel about the actions that Donald Trump took over the weekend?
So there are two really big question marks in my mind about the developments over the weekend. One is, what is the Trump administration's plan for a democratic transition in Venezuela? We've heard President Trump say that the U.S. is going to run the country, that the U.S. is going to pressure Vice President, Interim President Delcy Rodriguez to capitulate to the U.S. government's demands. But we have a situation in which there is a democratically elected president of Venezuela that wasn't allowed to transition to power, Edmundo González. Maduro stole that election in 2024. Is the U.S. government going to support Edmundo González returning to Venezuela and forming a government, or are there going to be elections to transition to a democratically elected government that is going to help rebuild Venezuela and rebuild the oil sector, which President Trump has indicated is a priority? The big concern is that so far President Trump has talked about rebuilding the oil sector without a democratic transition. And that, to me, is a big concern.
Right. He's called it a judicious transition, not a democratic one, as you pointed out. And it's interesting you mentioned Edmundo González, another name that a lot of people thought might be in the running for the leadership of the country is Corina Machado. But Donald Trump dismissed her very quickly. And I was a bit surprised by that. I'm wondering, Roxana, what your take was on his statements about her.
It was very surprising because Maria Corina Machado won the opposition primary in 2023. She had 90% of over 2 million opposition voters that came out to vote for a primary after the opposition negotiated terms for an election with the Maduro regime. This was a negotiation that the U.S. government supported. Without that negotiation and without a roadmap to elections, there would not have been such a successful primary in which she was elected to be the candidate to face Maduro. Maduro saw her as a threat and did not allow her to run. Mm-hmm. And instead, Maria Corina Machado supported Edmundo González as her successor to face Maduro in an election, which he did win. And of course, Maduro refused to accept those results. So to indicate that Maria Corina Machado, or by extension, the opposition, does not have the support of the Venezuelan people is inaccurate, in my view. The Venezuelan people have spoken. They are ready to turn the page on Maduro, turn the page on Chavismo, and usher in a change and a transition to democracy.
All right, let's turn to some of the legal issues now. Jeremy Paul, there's a couple of them I want to unpack with you. One is the issue of international law. A lot of people say Maduro is a really bad guy, dictator, oppressive. We're happy he's gone, but we don't like the way it was done because it was a violation of Venezuelan sovereignty. And the second is about Maduro in court himself and where that goes. So let's start with the international law piece. Is this a violation of international law? And if so, how serious is that?
Well, like many things, there's a case that it is a violation of international law. Certainly, there was no Security Council resolution authorizing the U.S. to act. And so the U.S. is relying on flimsy arguments about self-defense based on drugs coming into our country. But without that defense, we really have no leg to stand on in terms of military force. The alternative rationale that our government has used is the idea that we were just there to apprehend a fugitive from our criminal law. But if that were the case, then once Maduro was apprehended, that should have been the end of the matter, and the rationale that we're going to run Venezuela would collapse. Now, there are arguments to be made the other way. Certainly, if the opposition party in Venezuela had sought U.S. assistance, that would have changed things. And also the fact that Maduro did, as your previous speaker suggested, lose the election and hold on to power anyway, makes his claim to sort of sovereign immunity less. But really, ultimately, in terms of international law, the U.S. is relying on the self-defense rationale. But of course, the problem with that is that if we were able to depose leaders of any country that was sending drugs into the U.S., that would cover a lot of countries.
It certainly would. Let's talk about Maduro himself. He was in court today for to appear on charges of narco-terrorism, drug trafficking, and weapons charges. He's pled not guilty. Were you surprised by that plea?
Not at all. Why would he plead guilty? I think that there is a possibility, and this is speculation, but that there will be behind-the-scenes negotiations between Maduro and his lawyers and the U.S. government to perhaps reach some sort of deal where he's sent to a third country. But in the meantime, if he were to plead guilty, he'd give up all of his leverage. So I would not at all surprised by that. And under existing U.S. Supreme Court precedent, he will not be able to raise the argument that he was seized unlawfully as a defense to the prosecution. And so I think the prosecution will go forward.
So if he can't raise that defense, he stays obviously in custody in the U.S. The trial will play out. Roxana, of course, it's not just Venezuela that's impacted by this entire state of affairs. Cuba is now looking rather anxiously at these developments, not only because they cut off the flow of support, financial and oil from Venezuela to that country, but because Donald Trump seems to have implied that maybe Cuba could be next. Do you think that is a possibility?
You know, I can't speak to what the Trump administration has in mind for Cuba, but I do think it's important to note that the region is, I think, in my view, unfortunately divided on the latest developments in Venezuela and the U.S. intervention there. We have leaders in Mexico, Brazil, Colombia coming out very strongly condemning U.S. actions in Venezuela, but you also have countries in the region that have come out in support, including Argentina and Ecuador. And so I think what this signals to me is, you know, in a situation where you did have a region that had a consensus position, you could see them play a role in helping bring the political crisis in Venezuela to an end through pushing and working with the U.S. government to transition to democracy, which will bring the political stability needed for there to be the kind of economic improvements and rebuilding of the oil sector that President Trump has in mind. Without that, I think what you could expect is more instability in Venezuela because you won't have a leader with a strong mandate right now who the Chavista in charge does not have a strong mandate. She was not elected by the people to govern Venezuela.
Yeah, and Jeremy, the issue of oil is also a legal one, I think, because, you know, a number of American oil companies, including Chevron, were basically expropriated by the Venezuelan government many years ago. And Donald Trump says that this is a way of basically, you know, recovering the assets or recovering what they lost. He's used language to that effect. Do you think there's any case for that there in his defense of what he's done in Venezuela?
I think that was a long time ago. I think that if our country was going to pursue that at the time, it could have done so through legal means. And I think this is now just a pretext for getting back our companies back into the oil business.
And how important is the oil business, Roxana, to this? You know, when you think back about the invasion of Iraq, everyone denied that it had anything to do with oil. This time it seems front and center and no one's apologizing for that.
Yeah, I think President Trump has been very forthcoming in his vision for rebuilding Venezuela's oil sector. I think the reality here is that Venezuela's oil sector has been degraded over many, many years by mismanagement, corruption, and underinvestment. There's no quick fix to Venezuela's economic crisis and rebuilding Venezuela's oil sector. It's going to take massive investment by the private sector. It's going to take structural reforms, including a new legal framework and a new economic framework in Venezuela to make investors feel confident that they are not, you know, going to lose out on their investment. And all of that is going to take time. So the idea that there is some, you know, overnight solution here, I think is very unrealistic. And I keep going back to this question of the political, stable political situation. Investors are going to want to have some confidence that the government in charge in Venezuela is going to honor the deals that they're making. And without a democratically elected government, it's hard to imagine a real meaningful rebuilding of the oil sector.
Yeah, and the last question I want to ask is to you, Jeremy Paul. The message that this sends that, you know, a violation of international law or acting outside of international norms is acceptable to the United States, does that send a signal to other powers, including Russia and China, on issues such as Ukraine and Taiwan, that asserting your sovereignty in your neighborhood is okay and you don't need international authority to do so? Is this a dangerous precedent?
I think one of the obligations on the Trump administration now is to do everything that they possibly can to explain what they're doing in a way that doesn't set that kind of precedent. I mean, I think that the real strength of our position as a country is that, as Roxanne said, that Maduro was not democratically elected and that we were acting to promote democracy rather than to undermine it. And therefore, that could be a way of distinguishing what might happen in other countries. But certainly the risk you identify is there.
All right. I want to thank both of you, Roxana Vigil from the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C., and Jeremy Paul, professor of law at Northeastern University School of Law, for helping us unpack these events. We will, of course, continue to follow them here and update you on the hour as to news around the situation in Venezuela. When we come back on the other side of this, we're going to switch gears and talk about the internet. As we said earlier, it's become clogged with a lot of stuff many of us don't want to see. And there's a question of how we can ever go back, perhaps, to a time when the internet was, well, a way of connecting people as opposed to just selling a whole bunch of stuff. Is that even possible? We're going to talk to Cory Doctorow, technology critic and author, about that on the other side of this break on Fight Back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio, with guest host Tasha Kiridan.
Welcome back. All right. Do you feel the internet just isn't as friendly as it used to be? Are you sick of all those pop-up ads, clickbait stories in your feed, ads in your Instagram feed that you thought were stories, but now actually no? They're just trying to sell you something and basically drowning in a sea of AI slop. Well, this phenomenon has a name. It is NSification. Yeah, the censors won't let me say the actual S word, but you know what I'm talking about. It's a term that actually became a word of the year a couple of years ago, and it was coined in 2022 by Cory Doctorow, technology critic and author, who wrote a book about it and is here to tell us whether there's anything we can do about it. Cory, welcome to the show.
Oh, well, thank you very much. It's nice to be on.
Well, thank you. All right. So the term that that I dare not speak its name, N-crapification of the internet, whatever you want to call it, it's the title of your book is actually N-sification, Why Everything Suddenly Got Worse and What to Do About It. Let's start by asking, how did we get to this point? Why did it get so bad?
Well, it's easy to blame people for making bad consumption choices as though voting with your wallet ever solved anything and it wasn't just a big conspiracy by billionaires to get you to vote with the one thing they have more of than everyone else. It's also easy, and I think somewhat true, to blame the ketamine-addled Zuckermuskian failures who run the internet because they are terrible people. But I think the real blame has to lie with the policymakers who created the policy environment in which those terrible people would make much more money by being as bad as they could. So, for example, in 2012, Stephen Harper's Tories passed a law, the Copyright Modernization Act, that makes it illegal to modify your own technology, which means that you can't like add an ad blocker or a privacy blocker to your phone. It means that if Facebook takes your news away, you can't reverse engineer the Facebook app and make a new one that puts the news back in, which means that no Canadian company can go into business competing with Facebook, replacing the feature that they ripped out. It means that you're just at the mercy of these American companies. So I think we really have to put the blame with them. After all, they're the ones who are supposed to be working on our behalf. Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk, you know, they operate on behalf of their shareholders and the false gods they worship. But, you know, we do have someone who's supposed to be in our corner.
You say this process unfolds in three phases. What are those phases for N-sifying our internet?
Yeah, so there's a pretty typical pathology of, I don't know if I'm allowed to say the word. Am I allowed to say the word?
I think we're not. I wanted to this morning, but I was told no. So,
yeah. You know, the CRTC is not the FCC. Like, you can, like, if the CDC lets you say the word, then you guys should too. Anyways, it's a word that sounds like inflitification, but there's a sh in there, and the sh goes in a word that means pooping.
Yes.
So that word, the process by which it unfolds is pretty characteristic. In stage one, you have companies that are good to their end users, but finding a way to lock those end users in. And once the end users are locked in, it means that they can't leave if the platform gets worse. And that's the signal to make the platform worse, to take away value from those users in order to give it to business customers. And the business customers get tempted in because they're getting some of the value the end users used to have, and they get locked in too. And once they're locked in, you go into stage three, which is where you take the value away from the business customers and the end users. You claw it all back for the shareholders and the investors. You leave behind the kind of minimal, kind of homeopathic residue of value that'll keep users locked to the platform, businesses locked to the users, and the whole platform turns into a pile of poop.
Okay, but let me reverse engineer that to you and say, isn't it, though, necessary for a platform to monetize itself? And we've, since the beginning of time, you know, television monetized itself with soap operas, ads for domestic products that popped up in the middle of the show when TV started to sell goods to viewers. Isn't this kind of the same thing? Without these ads, without the commercial aspect, these platforms wouldn't survive.
Oh, yeah, I'm not making an argument against commercialism. It's fine that there are businesses that make money. But look, the kind of platonic ideal of a business, right, if you're sitting there kind of sketching out what the most perfect business would be a business that charged infinity for the things it made and paid $0 to make those things. And unless you're an academic publisher, you can't run a business like that. If you charge infinity, your customers will go somewhere else. If you pay nothing, your suppliers will go somewhere else. And the extent to which companies can get away with ripping us off is determined, again, not by, the vast forces of history or the iron laws of economics. It's about what we punish and what we don't. You know, if we let companies buy all of their competitors, right? Say we let, I don't know, Galen Weston do the world's crummiest Les Mis tribute by buying all the other grocers and then jacking up the price of bread, then they don't have to worry about competition. Right. And that's the thing Mark Zuckerberg was able to do. He bought Instagram. He bought WhatsApp. Google is a buying things company. You know, you take away the companies they acquired. They don't have a mobile platform, an ad tech stack, a video platform, maps, documents, collaboration. They're a buying things company. Tim Cook buys 90 companies a year for Apple. Right. He's bringing home a new company for his shareholders more often than you bring home groceries for the family. And so you take away competition. You let them capture their regulators, right? So that, you know, for example, in America, they haven't passed a new privacy law since 1988 when Ronald Reagan made it illegal for video store clerks to disclose your VHS rentals. And there hasn't been a new privacy law since. So why do these companies spy on us? It's not because they have a profit motive. It's because they have a profit motive and no one says you're not allowed to spy on people. So that's why they do it. You know, we have payment processors who could make more money if when they took money from us, they just didn't give it to the people we were sending it to. But they don't steal all of our money. And the reason they don't steal all of our money is not that that wouldn't be more profitable. It's that they would face consequences. So we create this environment in which being as crummy as possible makes you as rich as you can imagine. We shouldn't be surprised if then these companies turn out to be as crummy as they can.
Right. And we feed into that. In fact, I always find it interesting that, you know, we actually do have power. Our currency is our data, right? And we give up this data in exchange for, you know, that 10% discount that pops up when you go to a website. If you order something from them, if you just give them your email information, we hand over, we do barter our information also for some forms of commercial gain. So is it the question of simply that we're not striking the right bargain? Could we strike a better one? Has it gone too far? What exactly is the, I guess, the balance here is that's being struck?
well, it would be great if we actually could bargain. And, you know, when we're on open platforms, we can't. So the web, it runs in browsers. Browsers are open technology and they can be modified by third parties. So not just the company that makes your browser, but anyone else can make a plugin for your browser. And 51% of web users, the majority of web users in the world, have installed an ad blocker that also gives them more privacy when they use the web. I work for a nonprofit called the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We make an extremely popular blocker called Privacy Badger that everyone should download and use that defends your privacy while you use the web. It's the largest consumer boycott in human history. But when Harper's Tories in 2012 passed a law making it illegal to reverse engineer and modify things, they set it up so that no app user could ever do this. So the majority of web users protect their privacy when they use the web. No one has ever installed a privacy blocker for an app because under Bill C-11 of 2012, the Copyright Modernization Act, it's a crime to modify your own phone to protect your privacy while you use it. Now, the practical upshot of that is if you're designing your website and you say, well, maybe I'll make the ads a little more obnoxious and invasive and privacy violating to see if I can make more money, you have to think to yourself, well, you know, if I make 2% more money and 20% of my users install a blocker, I come out behind, not ahead. So I better not do that. But if you've got an app that you're thinking about making more obnoxious and invasive, why wouldn't you make it as obnoxious as possible? It doesn't matter if those users say, well, that's it. I'm going to try and install a blocker, because when they search for how do you block ads and defend your privacy with an app, the answer is it's been a crime since 2012 in Canada to defend your privacy while you use an app. An app is just a website with the right kind of IP to make it a crime to defend your privacy while you use it, which is why every company is so incredibly horny to get you to use their app instead of their website so they can steal your privacy while you're using it. If it was a bargain, you could say no, right? But you can't say no.
So is the solution,
if you use the service, they take your private data.
I this is fascinating because I've resisted downloading a million apps because my phone also didn't have the capacity. And then, you know, it always happens and you get clogged, you get a new phone. But are you saying that it's actually smarter to transact with companies on the web, on their website, as opposed to downloading the app? Is that something we should consider?
Absolutely. Although, again, I want to counsel that this is not consumer protection advice, right? Consumer protection doesn't come from consuming really consciously. It comes from making it illegal to steal from you, right? Trying to protect your privacy and have a better internet experience by very consciously choosing your technology is like trying to save yourself from wildfires by recycling very conscientiously, right? It's true that you should recycle and you should choose products that give you a better experience and so on, but don't kid yourself that you're voting with your wallet, right? If you want to fix this, we should maybe ask our leaders, rather than flushing billions of dollars into AI, a product that loses money every time someone uses it, maybe we should revise the law that makes it illegal for us to fix American technology. And then Canadian companies could go into business fixing American technology and selling those products all over the world, especially because the reason we have that law, the reason we passed that law in 2012, is that the American government threatened us with tariffs unless we passed that law.
In 2012.
And then we hit tariffs anyway.
All right. So in the last minute we have left here, just we're not going to change that law overnight. What can people do to protect themselves concretely against their loss of privacy right now?
Get involved in a movement. Join openmedia.ca. Join the Electronic Frontier Foundation at EFF.org. Get involved as a citizen and not as a consumer. You're better than being just an ambulatory wallet. You are a person who has political agency and is deserving of moral consideration whether or not you're spending money. It's not because you're not paying for the product that you're the product. It's because they can get away with treating you as the product that you're the product. Moral consideration is not a customer loyalty perk. It's a thing that firms give you if they have no choice. We have to take away the choice to rip you off and degrade you when you use the internet.
Wow. Okay. Well, you know what? This is a great way to start off the year. If you've got any New Year's resolutions, there you go. Get involved in the movement. Thank you so much, Cory Doctorow, for joining us today. That's all we've got time for today on Fight Back. But I will be back in the chair on Wednesday. And I believe that Jane Brown is in the chair tomorrow. So please stay tuned with us. And we look forward to more conversations this week.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.